Machine, I'll just repeat that I'm Harry Huxell, the pastor of an AELC congregation in Indianapolis, Indiana. We'll be talking about ministry in the New Lutheran Church today. One of the things that we'll do tomorrow is to examine some of the hopes and some of the fears that you've expressed about the New Lutheran Church. We've tabulated those that we have received. If some of you have not done that, if you haven't listed for us the hopes and fears that you have for the New Lutheran Church, I'll give you a card. Anybody need one? Okay. And if you would express on one side of the card three hopes that you have, and the other side three fears that you have. Okay?
Three. I just have one.
Okay. Look down just the one. That'll get tabulated. Okay. Anybody else? We've got yours yet. All right, good. Now, in talking about ministry in the New Lutheran Church, you would think that that's a fairly simple thing to do, that everybody ought to be able to understand what ministry is. And yet, that's not so simple. And the reason that it's not so simple is because there are varying opinions as to what ministry should be. The New Testament is not too clear as to how we should establish the office of the ministry. When you think about it, what kind of training did Jesus have for the ministry? Do you know?
He was brought up in a very fine home.
He was brought up in a good home. What do we know about his training?
He was a regular minister to the synagogue.
He visited the synagogues, he went there. We get the impression that he was recognized as a rabbi, but we're not told that he went to a rabbinical school. In contrast to that, we have the Apostle Paul, who mentions the fact that he was trained as a rabbi. But then remember that Paul also claimed for himself the credential of being an apostle. You know, and that became a controversial issue in the church at Corinth. So we're not always clear as to how these public figures came to the foreground in the ministry. That's true of the Old Testament too. When was a prophet a prophet? You know. There was the school of the prophets. There were all kinds of false schools of prophets. So it's a difficult thing to establish just how ministry was created in the New Testament. Well, because of that, because the New Testament is so casual about that, we developed different styles. In the Roman Catholic Church, we talk about the priesthood, and they have a hierarchical system. In the Episcopal Church, we have an episcopate, also a hierarchical system, but somewhat different from the Roman Catholic Church. Then we have the Presbyterian system. What kind of system do you think that we have in the Lutheran Church? Well, how would you describe our system?
Depends upon which synod you're in,
too. But generally, we think of it as being rather democratic. So we think of a democratic model for choosing and electing pastors. But now we talk about the pastoral office, and we're not too clear on that. How is the pastoral office achieved? There are some who suggest, well, it's just because of the necessity of the office. Command is there to go and preach the gospel, teach all people, make disciples of nations, and so we simply do what's practical. We just pick somebody out. There are some who say, well, this grows out of the priesthood of believers and the congregation, which is a grouping of priesthood of believers, then select somebody and they transfer their authority to the pastor. There are still others who suggest that the office of the pastor is really a given thing, that God calls people to be pastors and the office of the ministry of the word and sacraments is established by God. Which one of those three would you pick? Which is your option? Which do you think is the way in which you go?
Oh, it's not up to me.
I'm
in Missouri Synod.
Well, what was the idea there? You know, Missouri Synod. What was the idea?
Divine call.
So when a congregation calls the pastor, they're doing that
under the guidance of the Holy Spirit that calls people, and then they confer that authority upon them.
But probably it's a little bit of all three. What's clear in the Augustana, the Augsburg Confession, is that we have the office of the Word and sacraments established among us. Now, what do we normally assign to the pastoral role? What would you say are the functions of the pastor? What would the functions of a pastor be? If you were to describe the office of your pastor, what were the things that you would list?
First of all, I think he needs to know every member.
He needs to know every member, okay? Why does he need to know every member?
So that he can be a worthy shepherd of.
So the pastor should be a real shepherd of people, right?
Right.
He should know those people, all right. And what are the things that he should do for those people?
Minister to them.
In what sense? How does he minister? What are his...
He ministers with the word, he ministers with the... to their health problems, he ministers to their personal problems.
Okay, so he nurtures them in the word, that's the number one thing. And the other one is say take care of their health problems, so
no,
he comforts them.
Personal problems.
Comforts and counsels them, okay? Comforts them and counsels. Okay, then what else would you think of him doing?
I think he should help direct them into the work of the church. If he knows each one, then he knows where their talents lie and can...
Assist them to be ministers, right?
Assist them to be ministers and use them.
Use them. So assist people to be ministers, all right?
Right. And same way with the teachers. I mean, he's better able to determine who would be good teachers of not only our children, but of our adults.
Okay, so that's part of the nurturing system.
That's right.
Okay. What would be the first thing, though, that you probably, when you ask, have we got a good pastor? Now, what do you usually think of as being his foremost task?
Preaching the word.
Right. So, principally a preacher, right?
Teaching. He's a teacher.
Preaching and teaching. All right. Preach and teach, all right? So these are the functions that we see in the pastoral role. Now, normally that's a person who is serving the congregation, right? In the past, we haven't had many problems with that. The pastor, the day when Steve's daddy and I went to the seminary, but practically every student who went to the seminary expected that when he got out, he'd get a call to a congregation. And at that time, that's a long time ago that his daddy and I went to seminary, the church was still principally rural. We were still a rural church. You know, that's just a generation ago. And so pastors went to these congregations and they served as pastors. Now what's different about the ministry in our congregation? What do you see as being different?
It's more varied, it's more different. Aspects like some could be chaplains in the hospital or prisons or mainly counseling and then of course there's chaplaincy in the military.
So there's a variety of ministries today. So we've got all kinds of ministers. So we think of the pastoral role here as being basic in the church, but then there are chaplaincies you mentioned. That's all a whole new ball game for those people. They have to be trained another way, don't they? We have CP programs today that's still only a generation old, and which we train people to be specifically oriented to the kind of care that's needed in hospital administrations and so on. So chaplaincies are new to
youth ministers.
Pardon?
Youth ministry.
All right, so that's another one. We realize that that's specialized. So, this isn't showing up very much.
And ministry to the senior citizens, too.
That's a new one for us, isn't it, huh? Boy, senior citizen villages growing up all over the place and nursing homes all over. We're all getting older, every one of us. And so we see that the growing population in America today are the ages, right? The fastest growing population are people 80 and older, right?
Right.
So something that we have to hear the ministry too, that's new to us. Going back again, and I think of, I was out in ministry a couple of years and I got called to a welfare agency. I wasn't prepared to go to a welfare agency. I wasn't trained in social work. But there weren't any pastors at that time. Today we've got a host of people who are prepared for that kind of ministry. So when I went to that agency, I had to go to school at the same time so I could be prepared to do what I was doing, you know? And then later on, called to the chaplaincy of the university. Again, a whole new milieu to be serving in, and had to get another education. Today we help people and train people for these various ministries. Well, there's a whole variety of lay professionals that we have in the church today. They are new. They have to be recognized, however, as ministries, and that has created a problem. The CNLC wrestled with the question of what is ministry in the new Lutheran church going to be? And who are we going to roster as the ministers? Now, there was concern last night expressed about what are we going to do about teachers in the new Lutheran church? The ALC and the AELC bring along with them people who have been trained in their church schools, who have had some training in theology, and we've been rostering those people. And the AELC, the teachers are rostered along with the pastors. Now, when we went to the CNLC, they said, "No, wait a minute, that's something new to us. We don't have that." And that really plays havoc with our understanding of ministry. We see ministry as being related only to the word and the sacraments, the public administration of word and sacraments in the congregation and in the community. Mm-hmm. And we don't know whether we can answer these people. What was the result of that?
There's a difference in philosophy between the LCA and the other synods. The LCA feels that they should, it's okay to have preschools and colleges, but that the rest, we should support our public schools. If we're going to drain our public schools of all the Christian kids, and same with the teachers. We should put our teachers into the public schools where all children get the benefit of being, not being taught Christianity, but being exposed to a Christian person.
And they can live out their Christian life then in that kind of community.
Right.
And if you take all the Christians out of the schools, what happens to the public schools?
Well, the same way with PTAs. Yeah. Then there won't be, the PTAs will be run by people who don't care about furthering Christianity, and before you know it, they'll do away with all the Christmas programs, and they won't be able to see a smattering of Christianity in our public schools.
Okay. Anybody else would care to express himself or herself on that one?
Yeah, but if the Lutherans don't do it, somebody else will.
If the Lutherans don't have parochial schools?
Right. In our area, there isn't a Lutheran one, but there is one sponsored by the Seventh Day Adventist. There's one sponsored by an off-breed of the Christian Church that's very, very controversial and has grown by leaps and bounds. So although we don't do it, our Lutheran tax dollars are going into the schools, and we are not too popular.
Uh-huh. Anybody else?
I think we should have parochial schools.
You think we should have parochial schools? Okay, why do you think we should have parochial schools?
Because the children are different than they used to be, and the parents don't seem to teach them as well. They behave as well as they should.
Uh-huh. Yes?
Well, I have had an experience about that. I taught in public schools, and two of my children went to the Christian Day School, and some of my grandkids went to the Christian Day School. And I see many advantages in that Christian Day School.
You see advantages too?
Yeah, I see advantages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And after I stopped teaching, I did a lot of substituting in those in the proper schools.
Uh-huh. Okay. Anyone else on this?
I think the biggest problem in our church today is that our Sunday schools have gone down the drain.
Oh. year. That's not every place.
Well, I realize it, and I wonder why. In our area, our Sunday school used to be a booming concern.
Why isn't it anymore?
Well, ours isn't, and has gone down gradually, and the other Lutheran churches are the same in our area. But the Four Square, the church is just booming with Sunday school.
Well, why has yours gone down?
I feel it's because we have not had a pastor who had that as a real concern.
That made a lot of difference.
And the pastor has to lead the people into doing that particular job.
Okay.
And the people have to be supportive. But you know how, like we talked about the job of the pastor, how are you going to split this poor guy? Six ways?
Mm-hmm. Well, the lay people need to come in and help him in the area of education. And every church, maybe I shouldn't say every church, but most every church has people who have a background in education, and they can come in and be the education committee to direct the education program.
Well, I make a confession here. I'm a pastor of the Central City Congregation, and I came there 20 years ago. It was my determination to keep the congregation and stay there. We sold off suburban property so we could stay there. And we built a nice new education building, cost us $500,000 at that time to stay and to do the job. And it was all for the Sunday school and every kind of educational agency you could think of. And we built that building for over 200 kids in the Sunday school. Today we got 50. Now why?
Population.
Is that because
population.
I'm less interested? Well, there's population changes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we ask ourselves, well, why are these Four Square people then? Why are they growing during the same time? What's happening here?
They put their church in a different location, though.
Yeah, that's why they didn't stay in the Central City.
Right.
They move every time the population moves. They also go where the families are, and they're feeding on a very conservative mood in the population today.
And they have
so it's not always the pastor, there are some factors, sociological factors that fit into this story.
There's a lot of children in the Central City.
Pardon?
There's a lot of children in the Central City.
There are. Okay, that's another one.
The population has shifted, but there's still, right where you are, lots and lots of children
lots
who are
of
very
children.
Needy.
Okay. That was one of the reasons why we stayed. And that's another whole story that we get into and what's happened to the churches. All the mainline churches that have stayed, even the black churches that have stayed, and are seeing that they're not attracting the people from the Central City. When they see the rise of the storefront churches again, it's because our churches, even the black churches, aren't streetwise. There's another whole cultural problem there. It's a very, very difficult one. Yes.
Well, I feel another reason some of these churches are growing, these Four Square Covenant churches. People are living in a very restless age, and they're looking for security. And when they come into these churches, they're told exactly what to do. You do this,
yes,
and this.
There's
they don't
a lot
have
of security.
Any, yeah, they have security there. Mm-hmm. They don't have to do any thinking on their own.
And they have good music. Amen.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, so we have to have ministers of music too. We've got to add them to the list.
Yeah.
The problem about Rosspring people is what we really started with. We realized how diverse the church is today and the many kind of ministries that we have to have. And in an area like mine, of course, if we're going to be streetwise, we're going to have to get somebody who can work the streets. We have to create a new kind of ministry for them, different from what we're used to. And our people are still commuting back to the inner city. They have to get used to a different kind of ministry to be able to do that. So we have a variety of ministries, and that raised a question, though, and it was a very serious question as to whether you're going to roster everybody along with those who are trained as pastors. Now, we have to make some arbitrary decisions about that. Well, there were some people who suggested that a neat division that we could make would be to say that we have ministers of word and sacrament, but then we also have ministries of service. A diaconate. There is a lot of talk about the diaconate today. Now, the diaconate is prominent in the Lutheran Church in America and also in one of the synods of the AELC on the East Coast. And so there's some talk about, well, maybe we could create the diaconate. Well, that's going back and forth, and there have been all kinds of decisions that have been offered or ideas that have been offered, but finally, in the last meeting of the CNLC here at Seattle, the CMLC decided to talk about associates in ministry. And if you saw a release on that, associates in ministry. Now there'll be the two ways in which pastors and professional workers in the church will be rostered. We'll talk about the pastors, but then we'll also talk about associates in ministry. Now when you get to this whole business about ministry and what it takes to be a minister today, you have to recognize that we in the Lutheran Church have been very fussy about the kinds of people that we roster. We have high standards for what our pastors have to be. The Missouri Synod and consequently the AELC bring to the Lutheran Church a tradition that at one time recognized pastors and teachers as being the same, and that was because their training was greatly similar. In fact, the early schools that they created for training teachers were called seminaries, just like the seminary for training pastors, and there wasn't a great deal of difference between the two. And the immigrant group that came to, the immigrant group that came to America was composed principally of people who were both pastors and teachers, and they gave the same kind of recognition to both. But as we developed our system for training pastors, we kept improving that and adding to that all along. And we in the Roman Catholic Church probably have about the highest standards for training clergy of all the churches in America. I help out at Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, which is an ecumenical seminary. They train pastors for the Christian Church principally, but then also for the Presbyterian Church, for the Methodist Church, and then a whole variety. See how many denominations are represented there? 14, 15 different denominations. And they all come with different traditions. Now, many of those young people who are studying at the seminary have been called as pastors already in congregations. They're serving congregations in which they are regarded as the senior pastor. They may be small congregations, they may be large congregations. Some of them have come right out of high school, didn't even have their undergraduate degrees. Some of them have an undergraduate degree, but they go right from college into the ministry. Now that's an altogether different kind of standard than we have. Now the nature of the program in which I'm involved is that we supervise these students, that while they're going to the seminary, we sit and meet with them in groups of fours and fives to discuss the kind of problems that they have and to guide them in their pastoral concerns and the kind of administrative concerns they might have in their parishes. But in doing that, I recognized how far superior our own system has been. Now, when you think of it, we started out with our systems of undergraduate degrees, and then we had 3 years of seminary, then we added the internship, and the internships are so highly advantageous to the training of these people. Well, how many of you have been in congregations where you've had an intern? Well, you see the difference in those people from the time they start until the time they quit. They just seem to mature. Well, nobody's more surprised about that than the seminary itself. You know, that when these people come back, they see the changes that take place. Well, who's affecting the changes? Well, the parish is. You know, it's there that the people help the young people to become better pastors. I remember that we had a succession of interns in Missouri Synod. We call them vicars. That's a German use of that term, which means a person whose seminary training is not complete. But we had a succession of them, and very good ones at that, and then we hit a snag with a couple of them. I had one who, in the middle of the year, wanted to quit. He was an extremely bright student. He was a merit scholar, and he just was a gifted young man, and I wanted him to do so much, but at the same time, he was expecting me to do it all for him. Tell him exactly what to do. Well, you can't do that in the ministry. You have to become a self-starter. You have to learn to do that by yourself and push and look for the places where you can serve and so on. But at any rate, in the middle of the year, he just said he wanted to quit. And I said, oh, what a loss to the church this would be. And so we worked with him. And he was so bright. He was, I sat with him for an hour. And he said, oh, my head is so full, you know, and it would be, literally, it would hurt him. And, well, that was exhausting by the time that he left. And he is just a prince of the church today. He's a very fine pastor. I'm really pleased that he stayed in the ministry. But I was exhausted by that. Then we got another young man came on the scene right after him. Boy, it was a mess. Emotionally, he brought a young lady along with him. We didn't bargain for that. And just everything was bad. And no matter what assignment he had, it seemed to go the other way and so on. After a month, I had to call the seminary. I said, you know, what did you send here? And they said, well, we thought if he was going to work out any place, maybe he could work out with you. That wasn't true. I said, well, I'm going to throw him back, and then you see what you could do with him. Well, anyway, I went to my elders, and I said, you know, this has been just a little too much, and I don't know whether we... They said, all the more reason why we should have vicars. Just think if we would throw these guys on the church after, you know, without the experience, without being tested. And so our internships for our young ladies and men today, that's a real blessing to the church. And we can be proud of the tradition that we have for training people. So we're greatly concerned about this in the New Lutheran Church, that we maintain high standards. Now, one of the things that has grown along with that has been the development in the seminaries. We will be going into the New Lutheran Church this time with 8 seminaries. Already there have been some merging of seminaries within the LCA. Yesterday when we talked about synods, remember that the history of synods in the LCA was that they very often had their own seminaries. And now there's been merger of many of those smaller seminaries into larger seminaries. And then on top of that, there have been the merger of some other seminaries. The Lutheran Northwestern was the merging of the two seminaries, LCA and ALC, in St. Paul. And there's been a merger of the two seminaries in Columbus, Ohio. We have now Trinity Seminary there. Seminex has been deployed, gone to Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, and will also be a part perhaps of the new seminary, and part of the seminary already in Berkeley. And we're looking forward to maybe establishing a seminary at Atlanta, moving parts of one seminary or another there. But at any rate, it's really nice to know that antecedent to the New Lutheran Church, the seminaries themselves already and their association have really been working at the raising the standards for our seminary training. I think that the schools have all benefited greatly from the mergers that have taken place, and they're all stronger schools.
I have a question.
Yes.
Are the education requirements of the 3 synods in the merger the same?
For the going into the seminaries?
No, yeah. I mean for their pastors coming out. Are the education requirements the same for all 3?
Yes, they've really tried to standardize that, if I understand you correctly, yeah.
Okay, another question. Are there as many women in, or more women in one synod that have come out as pastors than in the others?
Steve, would you know about that? I think that we're seeing, we saw a rise, of course, we saw this growing in both the LCA and ALC, and in AELC also, Seminex, the number of ladies who have entered the seminary, and they really seem to be the cream of the crop, too. We really have some very fine ladies going into the seminary. The difficulty is the placing of ladies afterwards. But that's improving, too. My own synod just passed a resolution that said that any time a the bishop now offers a list to a congregation, he has to include at least 2 women. And I think that will help that situation immensely. But I think that more and more we're conscious of trying to place the ladies. But that has tapered off now somewhat, too. I think because of the difficulty we've had in placing ladies in positions, that that's slowed down somewhat. Okay? You have more questions about that?
No, I just served on a call committee, and it was one of the things that the people in our congregation did not want with the lady pastor. And the feeling among our people was if there was an assistant, that would be fine to have a woman. But as for the lead pastor, And I'm sure that's going to change, but it hasn't changed, in, especially in the smaller areas at this point.
I think it will change. Young lady in our congregation has just finished her second year at Trinity Seminary in Columbus. And I could hardly wait to ask her to preach her first sermon, you know, because we want to put her out there where the people can see how efficient and proficient she is. She's a very fine young lady. Well, her first year, she was not able to take a preach yet. She had to take a course with Steve's daddy in her second year first before she was allowed to do that. And then she did preach her first sermon for us on Good Friday. But before that, we had her assisting with the liturgy in the summer. As soon as she came home, we trotted her out again. And that has done so much to prepare our congregation for the time when, if we have to call a pastor, that they should consider seriously a lady pastor. And I think that's what we have to do.
I hope that some of us are experiencing here.
Yes, with Ruth, excellent Bible student. Yes, that helps immensely. Right.
I think most people here know Nancy Winder, and she has turned out to be very good.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. She's the pastor at Faithless in Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
The only one they have.
Yeah. And then, that has to be seen, that people get to recognize. I know that one stage, one of the bishops told me that the men in the congregations are far more accepting of this than the women are.
I think so.
And said that when there's a call committee and they're considering a new pastor, that if there are ladies on the committee, that's apt to put the kibosh on the lady being called. But if you have an all-male call committee, that they are far more disposed to calling a lady pastor.
I wonder what would happen if it was an all-women call committee. Because I think all women in a group are different from mixed men.
That group probably too, yeah.
I bet you get a woman out of
there. I have a question about placing of interns. Are they placed in a congregation who asks for one by the seminary, or does the pastor of the local church have a choice?
Well, when you're talking about an assistant now?
I'm talking about an intern.
Oh, an intern. Most generally, I think the assignment comes from the seminar, but I think that there's some play in the way in which that's done. Some pastors probably would insist on interviewing the student. Generally, I think that the seminaries like to place them according to their needs and according to their abilities. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Well, I was wondering because when I was in high school, which I think it was many long years ago, it was that I was confirmed in First Lutheran Williston, which is the old ELP church, and for 3 years we had an intern, but during my junior year we weren't able to get one, and I don't know why.
Well, sometimes
there was a shortage it's that year or what? I don't know.
Well, the seminaries are pretty careful about that, and for a good reason. Sometimes where the intern has been serving, if the pastor does not become a real good supervisor, you know, and if he isn't a good supervisor, then they're not going to send him the next one, because they don't want him in and up washing the pastor's car and running a mimeograph and that kind of thing. They don't want him to be, they want the student to really learn, whether it's a lady or a man, a student, they want them to learn. It's supposed to be a schooling situation. In some instances, it could be that there's just not enough students to go around, that the number of requests is greater than the number of people. Then also, let's say it's a good situation, you said that the pastor was a good supervisor, they just don't have somebody to match up with them at that point. So they're pretty careful about how they do that.
Well, we lived in a cosmopolitan area, our church in the cosmopolitan area, in almost inner Seattle for a while. And Dave Friedinger, I don't know if you know him.
Yes, sure I do.
He was our pastor. And he asked for Oriental, we had three Oriental vicars, and we had one black deaconess. But the deaconess didn't work out. She was too homesick and too immature because
But he asked for those, especially at that time. Yes. You can make special requests like that. That's for sure. You mentioned deaconess. That's another ministry that we have to talk about. What do you think is happening to the deaconess program today? Why not? Pardon?
I don't even know. I couldn't tell you what a deaconess is. I've heard of them.
Well, so many of the ladies that had been entering into the deaconess program in order to teach in the church or to serve in a variety of ways are now heading to the ministry because that's a possibility for them. So I think that that has cut into the deaconess program, but the deaconess program is very much alive. Now, the deaconess program, I taught a couple semesters at Valpo while I was serving a parish in Palos Park, Illinois, and ran down a couple of that, and I had a block of deaconesses. At that time, they took a major in religion. Their major was in religion, and then they had to take a second major, which whatever their field was going to be. But they could go into nursing, they could have gone into social work, they could have been secretaries, they could have been a variety of callings within the church, but they did have to have a major in religion. And it was a marvelous group of students. I really appreciated having the opportunity to teach them. But now, most of those young ladies who are as gifted as they were are heading to the ministry, and so the deaconess program probably will not be as large a program as it had been in the past. But that's another one of those associates in ministry that we're going to have in the New Lutheran Church.
Can men go into that program?
Pardon?
Do men go into that program?
They have. Now, when we talk about the diaconate, and we're talking about the men or ladies serving in that, very often we mean something quite apart. The diaconate, as it's been constituted in the LCA and the East Coast Synod of the ALC, is a program really designed to have the persons serve in liturgical functions of the church, but they can't celebrate the sacrament. Liturgical functions, and then also some service programs, maybe visitation of the sick and so on, the deacons that you're talking about there. So, but that's... Pardon?
Are those sex-specific activities, or the activities that are better suited to one sex than the other?
I don't think so. I think that will certainly be mixed. My guess would be, I'm not into that well enough to be able to answer how that's finally going to be designed. But there's a lot of experimentation with that right now. I would not think that one would be better suited than the other.
I have a question about the conventions next month. They're going to be held. Is there going to be any scuttlebutt, or is the merger just going to be voted in with no problems?
Okay. I suppose that we could be fairly certain that the merger. We shouldn't even talk about it as a merger. We should talk about the creation of the New Lutheran Church will be affected, and that it will be supported very, very strongly by all three of the Uniting Church bodies. There was some fear that was not going to happen. Some misgivings had been expressed by the bishops of the LCA, but those have been satisfied largely now. I know Dr. Crumley, the bishop of the LCA, expressed some very, very strong misgivings at one point. He's changed his mind completely about that now. He seems satisfied with the compromises that have been effected, and he's supporting it all the way. Dr. Price, Bishop of the ALC, has certainly been pushing very, very hard for it. And AELC, we're just rooting and cheering for it because we got to go someplace. We can't go on the way we are. We're too small and ineffective the way that we are, and so we have to jump in somewhere, and so we're cheering for it all over the way. So I don't think there will be some real problems with that.
Good, I'm glad, because if you read the papers, there are all these questions that we didn't hear at first about at all. Yeah. I think it's even stirred some of the people who wouldn't know we were going to have a merger up into thinking, oh, what are we doing? And maybe that's good. Hopefully it's good.
Steve, did you have your hand up to chip
in?
Yeah,
I have a personal stake in this question. That is, where are non-traditional ministries going to be in the new church? And I mean, it's, we don't even fit under chaplaincy heads. I came out of Seminex in the early years, and there was much encouragement. Guys, go out and be creative, do new things. And some of us took them up on it. And now what's actually happened is that our experience has brought us to a new place in understanding the ministry and our relationships with, quote, the world out there, which doesn't really exist for us. There are two types of worker priests, those who work in parishes part-time and outside jobs, and trying to bring those two together or become full-time parish. And others of us, our calls are working in the community, doing the kinds of work that we're doing. Now we've become a bit of an embarrassment for the church. And I think one of the odd places I've discovered I'm in is that I've become an elder at my tender young age in the field in which I'm working. And the church hierarchy does not understand it. It's not within the frame of reference the kind of work that we're about. And we're threatening, is at least that's some of the response we get. That's what I feel, yeah. That I know I don't fit in the pigeonhole.
Are there other ministries you like yours?
No. I feel I've been called to do the work that I'm doing, which is, you know, primarily has been in theater, has been in crisis intervention counseling. With street people, I am streetwise.
Right.
I've got that kind of stuff under the belt, and I'm not about to give it up to fit or conform in some other model now. It's for me, it's become, frankly, as I, in all of our ministries, it's an experiment with our lives. This is not administrative detail as to whether I can fit in. I think the church is broad enough, and that's one of the things I marvel and glory in terms of the Catholic Church, is that things get broader and broader these days, and new ministries, they can't get enough of them. Whereas our focus hits network. Sorry for taking the floor, but
That's the heart of the debate between, you know, who do we roster as pastors in the New Lutheran Church? Just what Steve is expressing. Now, the AELC has, you know, tried to make room for that to happen so that we do not lose sight of these unique ministries and that we be creative. And that's a very important thing. Now, the upshot of that was to roster people these two ways, pastoral ministry and then associates in ministry. But in addition to that, they also said that there is to be a six-year study after the new church is effective, that there be a six-year study in which we will talk about ministry and look at the various ways in which we have to describe ministry and make room for ministry. That the trend of the church should be for always to broaden the base for ministry. That's what we should be doing all the time. Now, we've been falling into some of that, but some of that's been very reluctant on the part of what you call the hierarchy, you know. That's very, very important for us to recognize that. Yes.
It's inconceivable to me that the hierarchy can't see that the restlessness in our inner cities and so on, that there is not a very special need for this kind of ministry.
Yes.
Oh,
thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes,
and there's also a question that the church is raising. You know, I mean, it's exactly what you just said, that we need to have people like Steve, we need to expand our ministry,
yes,
because we're so racist, we're so stuck on being white and Western European and having our cultural thing go on,
right,
and not be willing to extend ourselves to learn about other people's cultures and make other people comfortable with us.
Right.
And the church won't be able to meet its quotas. We've got to open up and not be so myopic. If we're going to exist in cities, certainly, and to serve people, we're going to decide that only white Western European are okay for the Lutheran Church, or are we
going to
open up?
Right. There will be a, we mentioned that last evening, there will be a commission in the New Lutheran Church that is called Multiracial Commission. I think that's multicultural. Multicultural, yeah. In which it will be concerned about that particular problem. Likewise, we said the commission on women, the same thing, that we recognize that we have to keep working at these because these are not within our tradition.
And we have to be able to tolerate having the person sitting next to us in a pew be poor, and that's a rough one.
That's true too.
Yeah, live with poverty.
Yes, ma'am.
The problem we have in our congregation and those around us are dealing with the gays. Should we permit them in our congregation? What's the new church going to do about that?
That's a good question. What's the?
Well,
there's the answer.
There's a tape here. You need to listen to it.
chop off their
head. My pastor Jim Ryan from San Francisco.
Jim did a real good session on that last summer.
Yes.
He laid out the biblical stuff on the...
He has a lot of business congregation.
Yeah.
There are officers in his congregation.
He's not the chairman of the
board.
Next.
Some of the most beautiful people I know are gays.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and they need to be ministered to.
They need wonderful teachers.
Well, while we're talking about trying to broaden this, as we recognize that the church should, and that should be a heavy emphasis in the New Lutheran Church, at the same time we recognize that the pressure from the government, from the federal government, is in the opposite direction, to narrow it, simply because of tax problems and all kinds of exemption problems that we have. I can think back to the day when we were thinking just the opposite. One of the reasons that our teachers got included in the roster of being ministers of the gospel so that they could get a railroad pass, you know. In those days we weren't worried about paying income tax. That wasn't a big thing, but then that got to be a problem. And how now are they to be considered ministers of the gospel and so on. So while we have this one need, and that is to expand the basis for ministry, at the same time we also recognize the pressures in the opposite direction. Anyway.
Very strange to hear you say it's the federal government that's trying to influence the church in that way. I wonder whether this roster in question is euphemism or some kind of code word for a financial arrangement. I don't know enough about the church to know. Are we talking different financial arrangements, people who are rostered or not rostered, and do you stop rostering someone for financial reasons?
It's a problem than just the benefits from the church's welfare programs. You know, whether they're included in the hospitalization program, so that's a big question of it.
So that is an economic question.
Sure, that's part of it. I don't think it's the major part. I think that there are two trends that we have to catch and admit to in the Lutheran Church as we're bringing ourselves to the New Lutheran Church. There are some people who have a stance that is towards clericalism. That is to say, the pastors are, growing out of that old German tradition, Herr Pastor kind of thing. That there are people who are bent in that direction. At the same time, there's also a trend towards anti-clericalism, right? And people say, oh, the pastor is nothing. And we've got to recognize that both of those are there. And I think that when we're talking about this rostering thing, it grows mostly out of a trend towards clericalism, you know, that the pastor is it. You know. And we want to get away from that kind of thing.
Well, what would be anybody in the whole Lutheran Church's argument against rostering Steve? I don't understand what the problem is.
Well, there's the big argument from the side of those who I would list with the people who are bent on clericalism is that there's a dissolving, watering down of the office of the ministry. That you want to be careful that whoever is involved as a rostered pastor, lady or man, is dealing with the word and the sacrament, that it has to be that. And if you don't do that, then you're going to dilute the ministry. That's the argument. And we'll see that that's a false argument. Because I think there are two things I'd like to talk about yet this morning we want to get in. And that is the office of the bishop. And then there's your office in the ministry. And I think that's very, very important to the whole concept of the New Lutheran Church. Well, now, we do have the office of the bishop. Now, what does that mean to you, that you're going to have a bishop, or that you already have a bishop, whether you're in any one of our churches, you have a bishop now. But what is a bishop? How would you describe a bishop?
I think of a bishop as a pastoral counselor, really.
Okay.
Somebody that the pastors can go to as a mentor.
Okay.
And also to see whether or not the pastor is suitable to certain congregations, and if they're having problems, what is the problem, and can he do anything about it, or does he know a solution?
Okay. You remember when you had a president who did that?
I wasn't as closely
associated with a presence, as I am with the bishop, because we have a retired bishop, Dr. Singerhammer, in our...
Do you like the term bishop better than president?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Why do you like it better?
It's connected with the church. You know that he is a superior officer in...
Okay. A superior officer. Remember those words. Okay. All right.
Well, somebody has to be on top.
Somebody got to be on top.
You can't all be a boss.
There we go. All right. Any other comments on it? Steve?
Well, the three things I guess I hear among discussions among pastors, what we look for in a bishop is somebody to be a pastor to the pastors, somebody to be on the cutting edge in terms of a very public figure to open up all of us in the church to new issues and new insights. And the third thing is perfect administrative capabilities. And most of us think God is merciful if there are two of those qualities in one person.
Yeah, right. Yes?
Well, I'm on the planning group in Seattle. We too are struggling with this, just where, you know, how do you identify as a bishop? And I know some of the feeling is that he should be in the pastoral role and also for this new issue and knowing what's going on, but the administration end should then be more the responsibility of this person they term vice president. We don't like that identification for that office. We think it should be called something else. Because he is the person that's doing all the nitty-gritty of administering the area of that synod, and that the pastor should not, or the bishop should not have the responsibility of that end, because he should be more in tune with his pastors. And also with the congregation, say a congregation is having a problem with pastoring their little group, that they can go somewhere to discuss it. And that, there doesn't seem to be any way for doing that.
Okay. Anybody else? Well, it'll be interesting to see what our expectations can realistically be. I mentioned last evening that the average synod will be about 179 congregations. That's quite a bit to administer in terms of pastoral relationship. If the bishop is really to be a pastor to those pastors, and we recognize that there are more than 179 pastors in a given synod, that's going to be something. I have taken a rather unpopular stance on this whole matter. I've fought the use of the term bishop. I felt that being in America, we have used as a model the government in terms of a democratic system rather than a hierarchical system. The term bishop is used in the Roman Catholic Church. And you ask a Catholic priest, well, what is a bishop? And he'll tell you that he can be anything that he wants to be. That's what it amounts to. He has that kind of authority. We talk about a bishop in the Episcopal Church, and we're talking about somebody who's very limited in what a person can do as bishop. And when we talk about a bishop in the Methodist Church, now you're talking about a fellow who's got some power. Bishops in the Methodist Church have considerable authority because they are bishops over usually a vast territory of congregations. So the term is not synonymous in all of the churches.
In the Methodist Church, they assign pastors to
the
church.
Yeah, he plays fruit basket upset every general conference. And usually he has to do that through superintendents because he has so many people, he couldn't possibly know them all. So the term is not used universally with the same understanding. And for that reason, but I think it's fraught with medieval authority. And I think we're going to expect too much from the term. Also, I've been the one who has said, why don't we have pastors who serve in congregations serve as bishops? That is, that they do it on a part-time basis so they can be one of the boys or one of the girls and have a feeling for where these people are at. But nobody listens to that. We're all looking for a certain kind of authority in that office. And I think that what we should recognize is that the bishops are going to be as good and as strong only to the degree that we make them that. So it's going to depend on the
sense. What's going to happen to the present bishops?
What's going to happen?
And their teams?
Well, some of them will not be elected. Some of them will be retiring. A good number will be of retirement age at the creation of the New Lutheran Church. So some of them will just be floating out of the picture. They'll just fade away. And some of them will not be elected. It'll be interesting. I think you raised a question for me outdoors, well, what kind of vying for power is there going to be in all this? And that's where the nitty and the gritty are. That's where the rubber hits the pavement. When we get down to it, what kind of struggle for authority will there be in the creation of the Lutheran Church when you have to elect a bishop? Do you know how the new bishops are going to be elected by any chance? Well, we'll follow what we call the ecclesiastical ballot, or the old Roman ballot. And that is to say that every pastor, lady or man, in a given synod, newly defined area, is eligible to be bishop. So on the first to go around, everybody will be a nominating ballot, and they will be able to nominate a bishop. Now, if the bishop gets 70 or 75% of the votes on the first time, he's elected. But if that doesn't happen, then they have to go for so many names. I think they boil it down to 13 names or something like that in the second ballot. And he has to be elected, or she has to be elected by a percentage of 60% or so on the second ballot. And it keeps going down. So finally, they end up with only two, if there's not, it's got to be a plurality. At any rate, finally, when they get down to the last two, then they also present the resume of the candidates. So it's an interesting process, and it means that anybody who serves as pastor in the area is eligible.
Well, will the pastors be doing the voting?
Pastors and representatives from the congregations will be doing the voting, yes. Every congregation will be represented according to their baptized membership and one pastor from the congregation.
Oh,
so there'll be both lay and pastoral votes. Mm-hmm.
When will this voting take
place? The constituting convention of those synods will be in September of next year. The constituting convention of the national body will be in the spring.
How many synods?
There'll be 65 synods.
Each one will have a bishop?
Each one will have a bishop. Then there's going to be a council of bishops, for which I'm fearful, but that's the new
how long will those bishops serve then? That's
a four-year term. Now, the elected positions on the boards are 6 years, non-successive. You can't be elected to the succeeding term, normally. Yes?
Are all of the bishops then going to be full-time positions? I mean,
yes, I think that. I think they will be.
That's
I think that's what's being called for.
I have another question. It's really not pertaining to this, but is there a ceiling on the top money you can pay a pastor in any one of the synods?
No.
Thank you.
I don't think I've reached mine yet.
And what's the bottom?
Yeah. There's a bottom. I know that they give you, but I just wondered if there was a top.
No. There's one factor yet I think that we would like to express, and that is that in talking about ministry in the New Lutheran Church, the important function that we talked about here for the pastors is to assist the people to be ministers. And that is that a pastor should be looked upon as one who enables the Christians in the parish to live out their function in the world. Now, that's not simply to get you to join the ladies' aid or the men's club or to teach Sunday school or whatever. Those functions have to go on in the church. And the Christians should take their place in that. But the number one function of all Christians should be to witness to the gospel where they're at, and that we would encourage all Christians then to see their responsibility for sharing the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. But in addition to that we see that our calling as Christian people is to live out our Christian vocation, as to whether we're teachers, doctors, lawyers, computer operators, whatever our calling is in life, that is where we live out the Christian vocation. That's where you serve as a minister. when you were talking here before of the business of parochial school versus public school, it brought to mind that my internship was down at 38th and Cottage Grove in Chicago. I taught in a storefront mission. I had parochial school. And I was so convinced of the value of the parochial school, I said, no matter where I go, if there's no parochial school, I'm going to stop and I'm going to teach for myself. This is such a valuable experience. This is so great, so wonderful. Well, as it turned out, I never did have a parochial school in terms of my